Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA. We inform you that any federal tax, state tax, financial advice, or information contained in this communication is not intended to be personalized or specific in nature, or to be relied upon for your personal situation in any circumstance. The advice and information are not intended and cannot be used as a tax opinion letter, nor used for the purpose of avoiding tax-related penalties. For personalized advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I'm a CPA, CFP, and AEP on the web at yourfinancialchoices.com and also available at wdiy.org. You can listen online, stream live, or listen to podcasts from prior shows. They are available at either of those websites as well. Today is Wednesday, May 2nd, 2018. The markets were down today with the Dow closing at 23,924, the NASDAQ at 7,100, and the S&P at 2635. Our topic tonight is conversations about long-term care planning as part of your estate planning. And that is a timely topic as May is considered Elder Law Month. So we are very timely on this. We are live tonight. We will take your questions. Lori C. is in the studio with us this evening. We'll answer your calls, take your information, and we ask you to mute your radio so you can hear us without the delay and we can talk without confusion. We do discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments. And while I typically have a topic each week, you can still ask questions off topic, and I will do my best to answer them. The number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. You can ask questions live on air or off air, whatever you're more comfortable. If it's not going to be on air, you're going to give your question to Lori C. She'll bring it into the studio and we'll answer it. Lots of questions generally about long-term care planning. So we certainly hope this is a good opportunity for you to get some of those questions answered this evening. If you think it's too complicated, you're welcome to send an email to us at yourfinancialchoices.com. I have a guest this evening, and I'm sure he'd be happy to respond to any questions as well, and we can do that during the show. Again, the number is 610-758-8810. My guest is attorney Dionysios Pappas of Vassiliadis Pappas Associates, LLC. Dennis, as he goes by, practices exclusively in the areas of elder law, trust and estate planning, trust and estate administration, special needs planning, and veterans pension benefits planning. He's admitted to practice law in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. He's a graduate of Temple University Beasley School of Law and received his undergraduate degree in political science from Temple University. Mr. Pappas is a VA accredited attorney for the preparation, presentation, and prosecution of claims for veterans benefits before the Department of Veterans Affairs. He frequently lectures and teaches and is a frequent guest of ours. Welcome back to the show, Dennis.
Thanks for having me again, Lori.
Hi, and I like telling people that we met when you were teaching a class, I think with NBI, a law curriculum or whatever.
CLE credits.
Well, I was getting CPE credits. So, and Dennis is very, very informative, a frequent guest, and people really enjoy hearing his information that he likes to share because he communicates it in a very understandable manner. So I'm very happy to have him. I've been gone for a couple weeks, so it's good to have someone back to kind of help me ease back into the show. So Dennis, talking about long-term care planning, you and I both know long-term care can be very expensive. It's one of the biggest concerns, I think, that people have. We know that Americans spend billions of dollars a year on various services, which we will talk about what long-term care means and what people think long-term care is. And then how people pay for long-term care, of course, depends on their financial situation and the kinds of services that they're going to use. So I thought it might be beneficial tonight to talk about some of the myths behind long-term care planning and present more of like a conversation because you and I like to talk about all of this kind of stuff. So let's hit on some of the various assumptions, myths, and misconceptions as we go through the show. And then also let's just talk about some of the planning opportunities that long-term care planning lends itself. So to start, can we talk a bit about what do we mean by long-term care planning? Because I think sometimes people don't always understand what that means.
Absolutely. Thanks again for having me back. I'm really excited to be here, especially in May. I'm always amazed how you do your job on the radio and you don't forget any of these things. So May's Elder Law Month, and I'm here and I'm really excited. So just very simply, what is long-term care planning? Because we hear these terms all the time and you and I, we take it for granted. But I think from an educational component, what's the difference between long-term care planning, say from estate planning or tax planning or financial planning or any other kind of planning? And generally what I like to say is that when our clients maybe get into that demographic, maybe 65 years old and up, they start to have special needs and concerns and issues that affect their demographic and how we pay for long-term care. How do we pay, for example, for caregivers coming into the house if somebody starts to need a little bit of help? We start to get into issues of what's the difference between a personal care home or a skilled long-term nursing home. And these things can be very expensive. In the Lehigh Valley, I don't think many people are aware that skilled long-term care in a nursing home can run anywhere from $10,000 to $15,000 a month, about $120,000 to $180,000 a year. So, you know, you get to wear two hats as a CPA and also as a financial planner. What would $120,000, $180,000 out of pocket per year do to even the most well-crafted financial plan, the most well-crafted estate plan? It would blow it up pretty quickly. So long-term care planning is a holistic way of figuring out what type of legal documents do we need, what we consider traditional estate planning, wills and powers of attorney, how do we use trusts in those situations. It's working with the financial advisor. What's the budget? What's the income, the expenses? What's the cash flow looking like? What is the healthcare needs of the client? I mean, many times we're not looking at institutional care. Maybe mom or dad or family member, we just need a couple hours of respite care where we have a caregiver come in and maybe just provide 2-3 hours every other day. So long-term care planning is that puzzle of bringing all of those things together, tax planning and figuring out for clients who are 65 and older, how are we going to put that puzzle together in a responsible way?
So I think that a lot of times people think that it's not going to happen to them, or they think there's going to be some other kind of coverage, like their health insurance. So they maybe tune out when they hear shows like this talking about the expense of long-term care or that anyone needs to do long-term care planning. So let's start with one of the first myths. People think they don't have to do planning because they're going to have Medicare. And doesn't Medicare cover long-term care?
Yeah, I love these myths. I mean, you and I have talked about these all the time. And I think these myths are really important. And certainly we've partly set the show up like this on purpose because these are exactly the type of questions that you and I hear on a daily basis. And so we're just expanding the audience. So let's talk a little bit about Medicare. Medicare does not pay for skilled long-term care. And when you say that to a lot of people, one of the first areas of confusion is what's the difference between Medicare and Medicaid? And those, even by attorneys, a lot of times they get interchanged. So Medicare is what we get generally, right? We only have an hour here today. So generally speaking, Medicare is you turn 65, you get your red, white, and blue card, and that entitles you to certain healthcare benefits. And most people pay a premium for that. Some people don't know that they pay a premium for their Medicare because it's coming right out of their Social Security check. So when you see your, whether it's your $109 a month, your Medicare Part B premium, it's no different than health insurance, right? You're paying a premium every month and you get some Medicare coverage. So what happens if somebody ends up in a nursing home is that you get very limited coverage. You might get up to 100 days. So the problem is if, let's say, mom or dad, they slip and fall, they have a stroke or they have a heart attack and they go to the hospital, and then the hospital stabilizes the family member, and then they send them to short-term rehab. If mom or dad get better in a week or two or three based on the rehab and they get back on their feet and they get back home, that's really not a long-term situation. And so Medicare, and your private health insurance are going to help pay for that, that's really not a financial problem. The problem becomes, what if the rehab place says, you know what, mom's not responding to the therapy. Mom's going to have to stay in skilled care moving forward for the rest of her life. Medicare will end. And now we have a long-term problem because the family gets that first $15,000 bill for the month, and now they're freaking out. What do we do? We didn't know that Medicare is short-term. We didn't know that the Highmark or the Blue Cross isn't picking up the room and board portion at the nursing home, and now we have a long-term problem. And long-term planning is trying to find a solution to that problem.
Okay. Folks, if you have long-term care planning questions, please stay tuned for the rest of the hour. And if you want to call in with those questions live, we are here in the studio. I am with attorney Dennis Pappas from Vasiliadis and Pappas Associates, and we're talking about long-term care planning in the month of May here, Elder Law Month. Phone number 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a minute.
In 2018, WDIY is celebrating 23 years on the air. If you listen to WDIY, support the station by becoming a member today. Members are our most reliable source of support, and we couldn't be here without you. To become a member, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7. WDIY, serving the Lehigh Valley and beyond.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Welcome back to the show. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. This is your host, Lori Siebert, and I have in the studio with me this evening attorney Dennis Pappas of Vasiliadis Pappas Associates, LLC, and we are talking about long-term care planning. And right before our last break, we were identifying the differences between Medicare and the assumptions or myths that people have that Medicare is going to pay for their long-term care. And then all of a sudden, once they're in the situation, paying $15,000 a month for long-term care, now is when they're a little bit nervous and probably wanting to do planning. And we're going to talk about when you should do planning and when, what is that window for planning as we go through the show here. But if you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810, and you can talk live with us on air, or if you're not comfortable talking live, give your question to Lori C., and she'll write it down and bring it into the studio. So, Dennis, again, right before that break, we were talking about sometimes people have the assumption that Medicare is going to cover their long-term care needs, and you indicated that generally it's typically 100 days, and that's pretty much it. But the problem is if it continues on. So Medicare, very different than Medicaid.
Absolutely. So Medicare, you know, if we're just doing little nuggets, we're not going to remember all the details. The biggest nugget to remember is Medicare is generally short term, maximum in most cases of 100 days. Medicaid, on the other hand, what are some of the myths here? Well, first of all, most people think they can't qualify for Medicaid because they have too many assets. Most people equate Medicaid with a welfare program. And so part of the public outreach and the education we're trying to do is, even if you have assets, Medicaid is part of the solution to that puzzle. And we're going to talk about other pieces to that puzzle. Where and when can we obtain Medicaid to help pay for the long-term care? Is long-term care insurance part of that puzzle? When should we think about it? How about doing gifting? Is it a good idea to do gifting before somebody enters a nursing home or after? Can they even do gifting after they enter a nursing home? Should I do things like give the house to the kids for a dollar? So those are some of the planning questions, potential strategies. When is it appropriate to use a trust or not? And so Medicaid is a piece of that puzzle. There's not one silver bullet. So if someone says, I have the answer on what your plan needs to look like to qualify and pay for long-term care, all of these things are going to be part of the puzzle. And obviously, each client is different. And so we're trying to figure out what's the best thing for that client.
And I think we can't reiterate that enough, that each person's situation is different and requires its own set of eyes from the professionals to see how their plan could be coordinated. So you mentioned gifting, and I think that quite often what I hear people coming in and saying, should we start gifting money away? And basically they have in their mind impoverishing their parents so they think they can qualify for Medicaid. So can we talk a little bit about what it might look like in the planning and gifting and how people may kind of maybe go the wrong path on some of that?
Yeah, so one of the things that we want to talk about is when we do gifting, what are the pros and the cons if we reduce it to its most basic level? And what most people think about, which you alluded to, is as professionals, we always hear, well, mom or dad can gift $15,000 per person per year. That, as you know very well, is a federal gift tax rule. That's not a Medicaid rule. So each government agency has their own rules. And so you might be able to gift $15,000 per person per year and not owe any federal gift tax to Uncle Sam. But what's going to happen is if you had a family member that was doing gifting, they might have different rules and consequences under the Medicaid laws. And so very quickly under the Medicaid laws, what Medicaid says is if you make any gifts of $500 or more total in a month, not per person, $500 total in a month, a very low threshold, there's a potential penalty for that. You're not going to pay a tax. You're not going to go to jail. They're probably not going to claw the money back. But here's what Medicaid says. This concept of a five-year look back that we also hear a lot about. When somebody is in a nursing home and they file for Medicaid, whether they have assets or not, Medicaid will audit them. And they're going to say, we want to see all of your financial activity for the last 5 years. And they're looking for what your assets are, but what they're really looking for is, did you do any gifts in the last 5 years over $500 total? And what Medicaid's going to say is, look, it's not against the law. Clearly, you're allowed to do gifting. You're not going to pay a penalty or fine or go to jail. But what they're going to say is the money that you gave away. I'm going to give you an example. If I gave you, Lori, $20,000 and you're my daughter, what they're going to say is, on average, there's a formula that $20,000 that you gave away 3 years ago, you could have kept that money and used it to pay the nursing home for about 2 months. And so the penalty is going to say is, Dennis, even if you're eligible for Medicaid today and you want us to pay the nursing home, Medicaid's going to say, we're sorry, we're going to stand back. And for the next 2 months, in this example, we're not going to pay the nursing home bill. Now, if I have other assets, that's not a problem because I have enough private assets to pay through the penalty period. But if I've impoverished my parent and the money's been gifted and I can't get it back, Medicaid will not pay the nursing home. And we had a session a couple years ago on the Pittis case, which came out of the Lehigh Valley that got a lot of attention nationally. The nursing home can come and sue adult children if their parents are impoverished and they cannot qualify for Medicaid. So,
and it doesn't matter if that was the child who got the money or not. It could have been Jenny in California.
Absolutely. It does not have to be the child that got the money. So the main part of this myth, this little section that we're on right now, is from a gifting perspective, gifting is okay. It's not bad, but it depends on what's your age, how much other assets do you have, what's your income, what's your medical situation like, and we need to evaluate all of those factors to determine, is it prudent for a client at 65, 70, whatever age they're at, is it prudent to do gifting now to potentially start protecting assets in the future? And in some cases, it's prudent, and in other cases, we recommend to the client, you shouldn't be gifting. And so as long as we fundamentally understand, I want people in the audience, you know, it's an hour, they're not going to remember everything. I would like the people in the audience to remember 2, 3, 4 nuggets. This is one nugget. The $15,000 per person per year rule can get you in serious trouble with the Medicaid authorities. It's not a tax problem, it's a Medicaid problem. So be careful with doing gifting where you haven't really gotten some comprehensive advice on whether it could come back to bite you.
Mm-hmm. And what sometimes people think is gifting might be not always gifting. I mean, so we can talk about that later. I'm getting confused there for a moment. Folks, if you have questions, Dennis is here in the studio with us. We are live. The phone number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. And if you're not comfortable talking live on air with us, you can give your question to Lori C. and she'll walk in and give it to us, and we'll do our best to answer the question. We are talking about long-term care planning, and we will take your questions. I'm a little early on my break, Shandi. Are we okay to go to our break right now? Okay, we'll be back in just a minute.
American folk music offers a variegated pattern of performers and styles. I'm Tom Druckenmiller, your host for In the Tradition. Together, we'll trace the roots and branches of American folk music from the earliest recordings and performers through today's talented players. In the Tradition, Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. I have with me this evening attorney Dennis Pappas of Vasiliadis Pappas Associates. And Dennis, before we go on, real quick, your firm also does presentations on this periodically as well. And if you want to just mention that, because sometimes people can listen while they're in the car, and then generally we mention this at the end of the show, but I think we could mention some of these presentations that you give. What are those?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a free 90-minute workshop. There's no obligation. They're at our firm's office in Bethlehem Township. The next two are on Tuesday, May the 22nd at 10 a.m. and Wednesday, May the 23rd at 7 p.m. The information is also on our website, www.lawvp.com. That's V as in Vasiliadis, P as in Pappas. And also, if you call the office, 610-694-9455, we'd be happy to get you that information to help you register for those free workshops.
Okay, and so that information is also available at lawvp.com. So when we talk about, I kind of mentioned gifting before we went to the break real quick, that people have different ideas of what gifting is. Anything to add on that before we move on?
A couple quick points, and we were talking about this at the break, but what you and I as professionals consider gifting and what the law considers gifting is different than what lay people think. So, for example, and I see this all the time, a client gives $10,000 to help with a child's wedding. In their mind, it's not a gift. They're just helping their child. But under the Medicaid rules, that's clearly a gift. Helping with a down payment on a home, paying a grandchild's college tuition, giving a loan to a child without promissory note or documentation and just telling the child, you know, pay me back when you can, and not having a fair market interest. Tithing, technically under the rules, tithing to a charity could be considered a gift. And so we have to be careful. So when you see fundamentally money that is coming out of the client's name and the client's not getting a fair market value back, that's where we start looking at some of those as gifting issues.
Okay. Folks, again, the number 610-758-8810. So let's talk about another misconception. My mother and father live in a nursing home.
It's a loaded term. What does that mean? Because we get calls all the time. Dennis, we heard you and Lori on the radio, and my mother's in a nursing home. What can we do? So two parts on this. What does this really mean? There's a difference between skilled nursing, a nursing home, and there's also a difference between, on the other hand, what are called personal care homes. They used to be called assisted living facilities. And there's two major differences. One's financial, and one's the level of care that they provide. And depending on where mom or dad are, there's a different prescription that we would recommend. So for example, personal care homes or assisted living facilities, for the most part, these are all the billboards that you see on 22, mm-hmm. that you're driving by and you see memory care. And I don't want to say any of the names. I'm not afraid to, but I don't want anybody to get upset at me for giving anybody else, free advertising. But all those billboards you see on 22, for the most part, are personal care homes. They're going to run on average of about $2,500 a month to maybe up to around $5,000 a month. You cannot get Medicaid in a personal care home. Personal care homes, from a medical perspective, they're really helping clients with what we call activities of daily living, walking, bathing, dressing, feeding. They're really set up to potentially help a client with maybe one of those activities of daily living, two at the most. And so what we really think about personal care is mom or dad's probably pretty good. Maybe they have a little bit of mental impairment, or maybe physically they're slowing down a little bit and they just need a little bit of help getting dressed. But for the most part, they're up, they're mobile, they're going down to the cafeteria, they're socializing. That's personal care. And so there's a cost to that, and you cannot get Medicaid, which is the most important thing. As an aside, we won't have time today, but veterans benefits for either the veteran or the surviving spouse, it can be really helpful in a personal care setting. You can get between $1,000 and $2,500 a month to help pay for that care. So that could be really, really helpful. Skilled nursing, on the other hand, this is what we really think of 24/7 skilled type care. Someone's probably bed bound, probably wheelchair bound, but fundamentally a rough rule of thumb is they need substantial assistance. I'm doing the little air quotes, mm-hmm. substantial assistance with two or more of those activities of daily living. And that's where that's really medical care. And so that's where you're going to start to see $8,000, $10,000, $12,000, up to $15,000 a month. So if you see that, when I get the call from the client, mom's in a nursing home, the first question I ask is what? How much are you paying? If I hear, you know, typically $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 a month, that's personal care. They're not in a nursing home. I hear $8,000, $10,000, $12,000, $15,000, that's skilled care. And the reason, again, why that matters is when we're trying to give a diagnosis, Medicaid will not necessarily be an immediate prescription that we're going to provide if someone's in personal care. And so it's very helpful and very important, I think, for the listeners to have a fundamental understanding is where is mom or dad, or where is mom or dad going? Because the legal options, the estate planning options, the financial options to them are going to be a little bit different in those two different avenues.
And even today, though, there are some facilities that do start with the personal care or assisted living, as you've described, but then they have the opportunity to move into the nursing facility or portion of that site. So that could also contribute to the confusion that people sometimes have, but it's literally the parent would be moving to the nursing facility portion of that.
The listeners at home, like, their head just kind of exploded because you just threw like a really great information grenade on them, because you're saying, Dennis, there are facilities that have these levels of care on one campus. So that's where it does get a little bit tricky, because someone will say, mom is at facility X. And then I'm going to say, well, how much are you paying? Because I'm still trying to figure out. So some places might only be personal care. Some places might only be skilled nursing. And then there's some places that have multiple wings and levels. That just adds the confusion.
And if you have a couple, one might be in the assisted living, one might be in the nursing care. So again, the real trick to that whole scenario is the cost.
I think that's really the best rule of thumb.
Okay.
When in doubt, ask the cost. And that's usually a really good indicator.
Okay. That sounds good. So when we go back to some of the long-term care planning that we hear the show and we say, hey, this could be a problem. We don't want it to blow up on us in 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. Should I be doing some planning now? Or you might have some people who say, I can do this on my own. I'm going to start transferring assets. You hear about people transferring assets to trust. Not all trusts are created equally. Trusts have different purposes. So let's kind of go over that. We have a couple minutes till our next break about when you hear someone say, I want to put my house in trust to protect it.
Yeah, so we need to be very careful with this. And I like talking about this specific question or this myth, this misconception, because as you said, there's many different types of trust, but there's a specific type of trust out there that I think, unfortunately, is being sold and marketed by unscrupulous individuals. It could be bad attorneys, bad financial advisors, just people looking to make a quick buck, especially off a very vulnerable demographic. And these are revocable living trusts. They're not all bad in all cases, but we need to be very careful, especially in long-term care. And here's what I mean by that. Many times, if you have a family member in a nursing home, in a skilled nursing home, and we're looking to qualify for Medicaid, and typically in a married case where one spouse is in the nursing home and the healthier spouse is still living at home, generally under the Medicaid rules, the house is an exempt asset, which is a good thing, right? I mean, that's a positive. That's one less piece of the estate planning puzzle that we need to solve right away. But if you put the house into one of these revocable living trusts, it loses its exemption. And so we have to be very careful, because these trusts are sold to people, and it's not the main part of today's session, but to avoid probate, to minimize taxes, or they're outright lied to. This revocable trust will protect the assets from a nursing home. I mean, I've seen it written in writing. And so we have to be very careful, and we have to be prudent consumers. So, you know, one of the things, one of the nuggets today is, if you have a revocable living trust, get it looked at, have it evaluated. Is it appropriate for you? And if it's not, now's the time to cancel the trust and put the house back into mom and dad's name. And so these revocable living trusts can be very problematic. I want to contrast that with other types of trusts. So again, not all trusts are bad, but an irrevocable trust is definitely a very common planning tool. And we'll talk about that, I think, towards the end. So I don't want the audience to think that all trusts are bad.
Right. They're not all created equal. That's what we need to demonstrate. Folks, we are at the halfway point. If you have questions, I know it's a beautiful, lovely night, but tonight's a great opportunity while Dennis is here to ask questions live on air or off air, whatever you're more comfortable with. The phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
For program support on WDIY, we thank Baldridge Asset Management, an SEC-registered investment advisory firm providing personalized portfolio management and financial guidance. Baldridge Asset Management, simplifying your financial life. For information, 610-336-4395 or baldridgeasset.com.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. I have with me this evening attorney Dennis Pappas of Vassiliadis Pappas Associates, LLC. And if you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We are talking about long-term care planning, some myths and misconceptions. And we have a caller on line one. We have Alan. Alan, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. How can we help you?
Well, a question for Dennis. Mm-hmm. You talked about personal care facilities. So I want to give you the example of where you're paying, you know, something like $3,000 a month for the care. Plus, in order to get into the facility, you had to make a deposit to be given the apartment of, $150,000, as much as $270,000, depending on the number of bedrooms in the apartment. So you come to the, you know, your people that are living in there, they come to the, you know, one passes away, mm-hmm. the other one survives, the second one, you know, eventually, you know, there's a pass away.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's supposedly under the contract of the long-term care facility or of the personal care facility, the heirs are entitled to return of that deposit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, per action of the will.
Right.
So the question is, the facility has a document
mm-hmm.
that is created, you know, like a beneficiary form, I believe.
Uh-huh.
And that document gives instructions to the facility, and it's written by, you know, let's be specific here, the husband, who had already remarried. The two people living there are not the parents of the children of the husband.
Right.
Oh, excuse me, I said it wrong.
No, I think
what I mean, it's a remarriage, so now you've got two sets of families
right.
involved.
Right.
You have those funds allocated among the two families.
Uh-huh.
It's my understanding from the facility that upon the passing of the husband, which happened, the spouse could go in and change the documentation, the beneficiary, and therefore cut out of the
recovery. You're raising a lot of great points. And so the first thing I'm going to say off the top, obviously, is your specific situation really has a lot of a level of detail, and I would need a lot more information before I could give you you know, the specific answer to your question. There's just a lot of things I would need to know. But here's what I'll generally say. What you're referring to is a buy-in. And so when you go to a healthcare facility for long-term care, some places do have a lump sum buy-in and some don't. So there are definitely places you could go to where you're just paying that $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 on a month-to-month basis. There's no buy-in. Other facilities do have a buy-in, and depending on where you go, it could be $100,000, $200,000, $300,000. Each facility that has a buy-in type contract, there are many different types of buy-ins, and so it's very hard. There's actually three general types. There's a what's called a buy-in A contract, a type B contract, and a type C contract, and they all kind of work differently. Now, one of the options on a lot of these buy-ins, it's not guaranteed, but depending on how much money you put down, there is an opportunity for a refund if you move out of the facility or if the resident passes away. And you've mentioned, you know, the family members passing away. Now, you have to really read the contract because there's terms and conditions to that. So one of those might be is they don't do the refund until they're able to re-rent that unit. So sometimes there could be a time lag on when the timing of the refund mechanism actually happens. So that's one thing to look at. The other thing you need to look at is under the terms of the buy-in contract, what is the ability of the resident to change the beneficiary designation? So that's what you talked about. And sometimes that needs to be negotiated. And you raised, for example, where it really gets complicated, is a second marriage situation. A lot of times is that's where we really recommend that before the resident buys in and signs the contract, that they come in. One of the things we do is we evaluate those contracts to give our advice on that. And you probably want to do that in connection with your estate planning, because if it's a second marriage, there might be a postnuptial or a prenuptial agreement, and who the beneficiaries are would be something that's negotiated as part of the estate plan. If you don't do that, you could run into a situation, which it sounds like you're talking about, where somebody's gone in and potentially changed the beneficiary designation, and now it's really not clear, or there's certain beneficiaries who are disenfranchised. So, you know, I would need to get more information, but I wish that was a great question. We should have had on our list maybe for next time. So thanks, Alan.
Let me ask you one additional.
Yeah.
You say you have to look at the documents. How do you get the nursing or the facility to give you the documents when you don't have access and you're not?
If the resident has passed away, typically, if an executor has been appointed, the executor has the legal authority to get copies of those documents. The facility is not going to gratuitously provide those documents, probably unless it's the executor or the person who's named as the beneficiary. So there might be an issue with, depending on where you're at and which hat you're wearing, on your ability to get the information. But generally, the executors of the will is the one that runs that show.
Okay.
Good luck, Alan.
Thanks, Alan.
Thank you. Okay, bye-bye. We have another caller on line three. We have Sue. Sue, can you hear us?
Yes.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. How can we help
Hi.
You?
Hi. I was given a check dated this year, and it says the final payment of the trust. That's all I was given, just a check. Now, I have this check, which I've deposited. But am I going to have to pay tax on that at the end of the year?
So, Sue, let me ask a question. You received a check payable to you. You were the beneficiary, in other words.
Correct.
Okay. So one thing I would certainly do is I would definitely talk to your tax advisor, your accountant, your CPA. That is definitely an income tax question. Now, I'll give you the general rule. We got to be careful, right? Because I would need to see the trust and all the details, and so would your tax advisor. But I'll give you the general rule is, generally speaking, when you receive a distribution from the trust, it is generally not income. Again, that's a general rule. Don't say, hey, Dennis said on the radio, I don't have to pay tax on this, and think it'll hold up with the IRS. But generally speaking, you would not pay income tax on that distribution. That said, if it is the final year of the trust, so if the trust is going out of business, if you will, and it's giving you the final distribution, it's going to close, you might get from the trustee an income tax statement. It's generally called the K-1 statement. K as in kite. And what will happen is some of that distribution that you got might have included interest, dividends, and stuff like that. So you might have to pay some income tax liability, but it's hard to tell if any of that distribution had interest on it. So the general answer is you don't pick that up on your tax return, but that really does need a specific evaluation from your CPA.
Well, Sue, is your father the trustee of that trust?
He passed away before my stepmother did, and then she was on the trust until she passed away, and so she was the last one on the trust.
There had to be another successor trustee.
That's who wrote me the check.
Right. That is the person you ask them, you say, am I going to get a K-1 from the trust for this distribution? As Dennis said, it may or may not have income tax consequences. You don't know until the trustee files a trust income tax return for the period. And the characteristic of the income that was in that trust may pass to you or not, depending on if there might have been some income tax deductions they could take against it. So basically, for your 2018 income tax return, you're going to want to make sure you ask, is there going to be a K-1? And the trustee may file a fiscal year in the last year. They can file a short year. You might get that K-1 in September, October, November, or you might not get that K-1 until April of next year. So make a copy of the paycheck. Just throw it in your tax folder so you don't forget to ask for that K-1.
Okay?
So it may or may not have tax consequences. The reason you might want to ask the trustee about it is because if it was a big check, and don't tell me what it was, but if it was a big check, you kind of want to know if it is income taxable or not, just for your own personal planning purposes.
And I'll only know that by getting this K-1 information.
Correct. Or exactly. Your sister, or whoever the trustee is, might know whether it was or not, depending on how skilled they are or how skilled their CPA or attorney might be who will prepare the trust income tax return. Okay?
Okay, right. Thank you.
Good luck, Sue.
Thank you, Sue.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Okay. We also had another question. Thank you, listeners, by the way, for calling in, because it's my favorite part of the show is when listeners call in with questions. So Ryan from New Tripoli called in off air, and he said, trust versus account titled transfer on death. So I'm trying to interpret this question, but I'm thinking what they are asking is, should someone use a trust possibly for their assets or planning, or a transfer on death account?
So, Ryan, just like you asked, we'll give you some general thoughts because that's a really broad topic. But generally speaking, what is a transfer on death account? TOD. Sometimes you'll see it called a payable on death account, POD. Sometimes a financial institution will call it an in trust for account, ITF. It's basically alphabet soup. They all mean the same thing. What you've basically done is, if Lori is the mother and Lori has a bank account with $10,000 in it, if Lori adds a beneficiary to that, she adds a transfer on death designation, and it says, when I, Lori, pass away, the $10,000 in the bank account transfers on death to my dear friend Dennis. That's a transfer on death account. All that you did is added a beneficiary designation. A trust is completely different, because if Lori takes that $10,000 and she puts it into, again, there's many different types of trust, but let's say an irrevocable trust, which we're going to talk about in a second, she puts it into an irrevocable trust. The characteristics of that trust are, Lori can't get her hands on the money. Lori does pay the income taxes, but that money's protected from Lori's creditors. So if Lori goes into a nursing home, if Lori gets sued, if Lori's in a car accident, if something bad happens to Lori, if Lori gets divorced, typically those assets in the trust may enjoy a higher level of creditor protection, whereas if she left them in the TOD account, there's no creditor protection because Lori has complete access to it. So the analysis of whether do we want to use a trust or not, or do we want to use a transfer on death account, many people, and you got to be careful with these, people use these transfer on death accounts because they think they're evading probate. They think they're saving on taxes. It's a separate issue then. Am I protecting the asset during my lifetime from nursing home creditors or anything like that? So it's an apple and an orange. TOD generally refers to after a death, but usually for trusts, we're trying to do lifetime planning and protect certain assets.
So, Dennis, I love the questions. So, folks, if you do want to call in with questions, we do still have 15 minutes, and that phone number is 610-758-8810. And there was a lot we wanted to cover tonight, but we are, again, happy to answer the questions. So I think when we come back from our break, I want to talk a little bit more about using an irrevocable trust as part of long-term care planning. Again, so much to talk about, which simply demonstrates how complicated it is and how you really need to work with people who are familiar with this. Even Dennis, you mentioning the veterans benefits earlier, that is a whole
another universe
on its own. Yeah. So there's so many pieces that people don't realize how they have to fit together. So folks, when we come back, we're going to talk about one little tool that could be used in long-term care planning. But again, the number is 610-758-8810 if you'd like to ask questions live on air or off air. And we will return with our guest, attorney Dennis Pappas of Vasiliadis Pappas Associates, LLC. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and you receive a tax deduction. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love on WDIY. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Welcome back to the show. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I have with me this evening an awesome guest, attorney Dennis Pappas of Vasiliadis Pappas Associates, LLC. Dennis, I want to continue our discussion on long-term care planning. If people have questions, we do still have some time, 610-758-8810. Questions can also be emailed through yourfinancialchoices.com, and I can always forward those to Dennis as well if they're directed toward him. So I want to mention again, before we get too tight on the end of the show, Dennis, I know that you do some presentations on this subject because it is complicated. Could you mention when your upcoming presentations are?
Sure. So we're going to talk about the trust here in this last segment, and this is what I call 90-minute free workshop, a lot of it on trust. So if you want the trust on steroids, this is a nice free 90-minute workshop. Two coming up. Tuesday, May the 22nd at 10 a.m., Wednesday, May 23rd at 7 p.m. Please do call the office to register because we do have limited seating, 610-694-9455. You could also get the information on our website, www.lawvp.com. That's VP Vasiliadis Pappas.
Okay, thanks, Dennis. Trust. It's interesting to me that for years and years, when the federal estate exemption was $600,000, people were using trusts like crazy. They called them the bypass trust, the credit shelter trust. And then it seemed as the federal exemption continued to go up, I felt like attorneys weren't using trust as much. And from my perspective, with the divorce rate, long-term care planning, elder planning, I was surprised that we weren't seeing people use trust as much. Now, you and I both know there are a lot of trusts that people have that they don't need. And there are attorneys or box programs, attorney in a box, that create trusts that aren't appropriate. But when carefully drafted for someone's specific needs, a trust can be a very powerful tool. We talked earlier about sometimes people think they're going to do their own estate planning, their own Medicaid planning, long-term care planning, elder planning, whatever they might call it. They think they're going to, you know, do it on their own, and they start transferring assets. They transfer assets, they gift assets, they transfer the house to the kids. There's so many different things they do. So with the rest of the time that we have available, can you touch on number one, is it a good idea to transfer the house out of mom and dad's name? You touched on that at the beginning of the show when you said sometimes those transfers of the house take it, you know, they're not as protected as they were. There's some other issues that they could encounter when they're transferring a home if they're not thinking it through. But then also take us to what could be one of those tools using an irrevocable trust, because you've mentioned it a couple times.
Sure. So one of the most common things, unfortunately, that we see, and whether it's self-help or whether there was somebody involved, is the common thing is transferring the house to the kids for a dollar. Now, whether it's transferring the house to the kids for a dollar, whether it's giving them cash, whether it's giving them stocks or bonds, fundamentally, we're talking about mom or dad taking assets out of their name and giving it to the kids. That's gifting in its most basic form. Some of the problems with that. First of all, we've already talked about potential Medicaid transfer penalties. If you give something away, and God forbid, within 5 years after that, you find yourself in a nursing home unexpectedly, you could have a very large penalty. You won't get Medicaid at exactly the time that you need it when you're in the nursing home. Now, you know, certainly when people make these transfers, you mentioned it earlier, no one wakes up in the morning and says, I want to be in a nursing home, right? I mean, you want to be at home. But what happens is sometimes there's a medical emergency that necessitates it. So again, somebody slips and falls and they can't rehab enough to get back home. They have a heart attack. They have a stroke. There's severe Alzheimer's, dementia. There's a medical reason why people are in nursing homes. Nobody's voluntarily there. And so you might be okay today. And then 3, 4, or 5 years from now, there's a medical incident. And now you have these Medicaid transfer penalties. Some other risks from doing outright gifting like that. What happens if you do the gifting and the child passes away before mom or dad? The assets that you were trying to protect for mom or dad are now exposed, and it's going to get tied up in the kid's estate. And I'll give you the example. So let's say I'm the parent, you're the child, I give you the house for a dollar, you pass away before me, your will probably says everything goes to your husband. So now my stepson, who never really liked me, says, you know, dear father-in-law, you have 30 days to vacate the home. I mean, we laugh at that, but that happens. Mm-hmm. Even if you did change your will to say, I'm going to put Pop back in my will, if you pass away before me, I have to pay 4.5% inheritance tax to quote unquote inherit my house back out of your estate. So, I mean, there's death is definitely an issue. Creditors, right? If you, for whatever reason we talked about, are sued, there's a malpractice claim, right? You have a child who's a doctor or a lawyer. Maybe they're a contractor. Contractors have tendencies with liens. I recently had a situation where the kid was a restaurant owner and the restaurant went bankrupt and mom and dad's house was part of the bankruptcy settlement. You can't turn around and say, well, you know, it's just holding this for mom and dad on the side. So death, creditors, what if the child gets divorced? You know, you give the house to the kids the dollar, now that house is tied up in a divorce settlement. So these are some of the traditional, what we call red flags in estate planning, where you got to be very careful doing gifting because there's these unforeseen consequences. You think you're protecting it from your nursing home care, which you might be, but now you're also exposing it to all of these risks. Death, divorce, creditors. The other main thing that I always say is, you know, we represent mom and dad typically, not the kids. And so I say, mom and dad, are you comfortable giving up direct control over your assets? And most people don't really think about it that way, right? They're saying, well, the kids will give it to me when I need it. And I say, I know the kids will give it to you when you need it, but what if the kids voluntarily can't give it to you back to you because you have these issues? So, you know, there's some problems there. In addition, we have some tax problems. And you know this just as well as anybody else, some income tax issues. If I sell my principal residence, under the Internal Revenue Code, Section 121, I don't pay capital gains up to $250,000 single, $500,000 married. What does that really mean in English? It means most people, when they sell their principal residence, they don't pay capital gains tax. But if I give my house to you, my daughter, and I move into a personal care home, and then you sell the house, guess who's going to get whacked with capital gains taxes? The child.
Because let me jump in, because what happens, people don't realize, is they think, oh, mom and dad transferred it to me when it was worth $250,000. And they think their cost basis is $250,000. And no, that's not the case. When someone gifts an appreciated asset, then that donee receives the cost basis and holding period that the donor had. So if mom and dad paid $10,000 for that house that's now worth $250,000, the capital gains could be substantial.
Yeah, the capital gains could definitely going to be in the double digits, no questions. So, you know, those are all the risks. So what's the solution, or what's one of the tools that in this limited amount of time we could talk to people a little bit about is an irrevocable Medicaid trust is often, I like to think of it as the Swiss Army knife. It's a very flexible tool, and it's something that we use a lot. So instead of gifting the house, for example, to the kids for a dollar, I want to get people thinking about what if you transfer the trust, the house, into an irrevocable trust. Now, what are the characteristics of this? I always tell people, in order to get protection, so in this case, we want creditor protection in case mom or dad have high medical expenses, i.e. nursing home expenses. How do we protect the house or other assets from that high cost of care? So what are the characteristics, the pros and cons of the trusts? One of the positives is the trust is not going to die. The trust is not going to get sued. The trust is not going to have creditors, right? The trust is not going to get divorced. So any of those negative things that happen to natural people, the kids, is not going to happen to a trust. So right away, we are really protecting that asset. Now, typically in these cases, the family member, the kids, can be the trustees of that trust. So usually the client is not the trustee of the trust. You need to appoint a trusted family member. So if you have a son or a daughter who's the agent under power of attorney, they're typically the ideal candidate for that. Now, the assets in the trust are protected. What are some of the strings to this? Number one, in order for the assets to be out of my name in my estate and protected from a creditor perspective is I cannot cancel the trust. It's irrevocable. Now, number two is I can never stick my hand into the trust and take assets out of the trust and give it back to myself. So some of the clients are going to say, wait a minute, Dennis, that's a little scary. Am I not giving? You just told me not to give up direct control, and here you're telling me to use a trust. What's going on? Well, there are certain provisions in the trust where we do have flexibility. So, for example, the trustee, anytime that the trustee wants, can make a distribution from the trust to anybody but the parent. So let's say I have three kids and I name child number one as my trustee. If for whatever reason I need to get access to those assets, the trustee can make a distribution to one or two of the other kids. And then once those kids have those assets, they're free to do whatever they want. So if they want to give it back to mom and dad, or if they want to use those assets to pay for something that mom and dad need, they could do that. So those are the major characteristics of the trust. After the parent passes away, we don't need the trust anymore. The trust will end, and then the beneficiaries are going to inherit the inheritance like they normally would have. With respect to the trust, you also get the positive tax benefits. So even though I'm putting my house in the trust, if I want to sell my house in the future, the trust can sell the house, and the trust still enjoys the same capital gains exclusion. So now there's no capital gains taxes. So there's tax incentives to do this. There's creditor protection reasons to do this. You still do have a degree of control over the trust to get access out when you need it to. And so in most cases, it's preferable to at least think about using an irrevocable trust. The last thing I'll quickly mention is you would never, ever take all of your assets and put it into this type of a trust. So that's where you have to look at what are the assets, what's the age, what's the medical history, to really determine how much, if any, is appropriate for the client to put in an irrevocable Medicaid trust.
I think that's great. I recently had a client in Florida, had an attorney in Florida draft up a trust document and said, what do you think? And I said, well, did he talk to you about the assets that you have and what are you going to transfer? It's a blended family. And he's like, well, no, we didn't talk about that. I said, I think we need to have a telephone call. The other thing I want to mention, as Dennis alluded to, this kind of trust has very, very specific language that an attorney skilled in this area needs to make sure is included to receive all the benefits of what he was describing. So you want to be very careful. This is not an off-the-shelf type of trust that someone is looking at. Dennis, really quickly, because we only have about a minute left, Anne from Easton had called. She said her sister tried to get veterans benefits from her deceased husband, who served in the Korean War but was not career in military. She was denied any benefits. I don't know if you'd have time, any advice. We only have a minute, or they could
I would say, Anne, you can contact my office. I'd be happy to talk to you about it. The one main thing you want to try to obtain is the discharge document, the DD-214. We need to look at when he served. There are specific dates that are determined to be wartime dates that we need to look at. And there's many different veterans programs. Some of those are based on what your assets and your income are, and some of them are based on did the veteran actually have some type of injury or aggravate an injury in the term of service. So there's a lot of veterans benefits. I'm happy if you call the office to talk to you about that.
And that number is 610-694-9455. A gentleman called to say, great show, and
thank you.
Did a great job. So let's give a little bit, your attorney, Dennis Pappas of Vasiliadis and Pappas Associates. Your website is Law, V as in Victor, P as in Paul, or Vasiliadis and Pappas, lawvp.com. You have a couple seminars that you're talking specifically about some long-term care planning options using irrevocable trust. That is May 22nd and May 23rd. Your office is in Bethlehem Township, but that information is also available on that same website, lawvp.com, and 610-694-9455. Say goodbye, Dennis. We're out of time.
I'm saying goodbye. Great job with those Greek names, Lori.
Folks, next week we have attorney Jim Ruggiero. He's going to talk about IRA trust. Thanks to all the listeners tonight. Really, really appreciate it. Great questions, great calls. Really enjoyed it. Coming up next, we have Tom Druckenmiller within the tradition folk music. Remember, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive. Thank you, Dennis. Thank you, Shandi. Thank you, Lori. Thank you, listeners. Have a great week, folks.